This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Frontro on The Bigger Picture and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. The late Ismail Zain is a familiar name in the Malaysian art world, both as an artist and a cultural icon of sorts. An exhibition of his works called Membayang Maksud is currently on at the National Art Gallery and it does celebrate his unique approach to making Malaysian art. The exhibition is on until the 17th of November. And joining me today to discuss both the exhibition and his significance to Malaysian art are the exhibition's curator, Jaffar Ismail from Fergana Art, and Badan Warisan Malaysia's president, Elizabeth Cardosa. How are you both doing today?
Good, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Shamila.
Oh, thank you for being on the show. I think for those who maybe are not familiar with Ismail Zain, Jaffar, do you want to set the stage for who he was and why he's such an important cultural figure?
I mean, Ismail, of course, Elizabeth, perhaps more familiar with Ismail at a professional level, working. But Ismail, to me, was... I first met him in the early 80s. Maybe in 1982, 81. And there was a particular meeting that was quite impressive because I'm an engineer by profession, by training. I was a businessman. And Ismail just blew my mind out because he was the first Malaysian artist then can actually say something in one paragraph, a set of words that's continuous, no grammatical error, in almost a punctuation marks in a sentence. I said, "Who is this guy?" And then later I found at that time he was the founding director, the first director of FINAS, Film National Berhad, and before that, of course, was the director of culture at the Kementerian Kebudayaan, and also the first Malaysian to be made to be appointed as the director of the Balai Seni Lukis Negara in Jalan Ampang.
I knew he was the director, but I didn't realize he was the first Malaysian.
I think he. And then at that time, as I get to know some of his friends, and I found that besides looking at his painting, it's extremely good. And the one that I always remembered was Rembrandt. After Rembrandt, woman, crossing the stream, very erotic painting. But Ismail to me was. The disappointment to me about Ismail was that he was not a prolific painter. He does one or two works and then he forgot about it. And later, after talking to the likes of Pia Dasar, I found that this guy, he's really a budayawan, a cultural thinker. He's more of a thinker than a normal artist. He can actually, he doesn't make things up. He actually know what he's doing. That's, to me, Ismail is one of the all-time greats. And as Zain Azrai said in the opening of the catalogue, is probably the most complete arts person the country has ever seen for a long, long time.
Elizabeth, you've had the opportunity to both know him and work with him in many ways. What was your experience?
I was a child and he was always Uncle Ismail because he knew my parents. So it was familiar. But when I finished university, and we would occasionally meet, but it would always be family. It was really a family relationship. I did performing arts at USM, and one of the things that I wanted to do was take a year between finishing my undergraduate and going off and doing a master's. And I decided that I wanted to work in theatre and education. So my father then says, "Oh, let's go and see Uncle Ismail." So we hop in and we go to Ismail's house, which at that time he was living on Petaling Hill behind, the old Istana Negara, in the Bellamy Road area. Yeah. And we went there and we had a chat. And he said, "Right, when you finish and you've graduated, why don't you just come to KL and we'll find something for you?" And it was sort of a very casual, generous, sort of like really, as a young person, I was 20 at that time, it was like, okay, lah. It wasn't an interview, it wasn't set like, it was basically, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do this? Just come and see me when you've graduated.
Very avuncular person, right?
Absolutely.
Like an uncle.
It was an uncle. It was an uncle saying, come. And it was sort of set up like, cronyism, you talk about it, right? My dad, who was his friend. And so I turned up at his office, which was at Gurney Road at that time, Jalan Semarak. Now, what is it called? Jalan something or
so
other.
So when you say his office, which
he was okay. He was with, at that time, he was Pengarah Kebudayaan with the Ministry of well, it was Culture, Youth and Sports. Remember that? I think it was the 11th floor, the 12th floor. Yeah. And so I turn up there and I sort of knock on his door and he says, okay, you say you want to do, you know, you want to look at children's theatre and look at, you know, theatre and education. So we don't have a children's theatre program. So why don't you just go out there, find some kids and start some work and we'll pay you on a, you do a claims sheet and we'll pay you on an hourly basis up to X number of, you know, hours a week. We expect you to deliver some things. And then every week you come in and have a chat with me about what you're doing. Or every once in a while you come and have a chat with me and I might call you for a meeting or two. I suppose nowadays you would say, you know, this never happens, you know, but this was like 1978, you know, 77, 78. And it was like, you know, it okay, you kind of like just jump into it because it's not something you think anything of. You don't think of it as sort of, you know, a favor. You know, you were expected to deliver.
So Jaafar called him a budayawan. How would you describe Ismail Zain as an arts maker, you know, a person working with culture as such? Like, how would you describe his approach?
I would say he was an influencer in that sense that he...
Oh, an influencer before an influencer was a thing.
Absolutely, it was in vogue. You know, if you look at what he did and what he said and how he actually helped, it wasn't like he was helping people. That was not his approach. He wasn't there. It wasn't gratuitous, right? It wasn't a handout or anything. Because everybody was expected to deliver, but it was... He made sure that he gave you the context within which you could deliver. Yeah. And I think in that way, he was supportive. He challenged you. I mean, you really had to deliver.
Yeah.
But he did influence not just the way you thought, but because he threw everybody in. I mean, you know, whether you were an artist or you were a dancer or you were a performer, you know, you were a writer, everybody got together and it was really sort of like family, but not, you know, still with tensions of family, obviously.
But he's a very strict disciplinarian.
He was. Yeah. You know, you were expected to deliver. I mean, you couldn't be punctual. Yeah. And you couldn't get away with, you know, being sloppy. Mm. I mean, that was really not something that was acceptable, you know, but he did it in ever so the nicest way. Yeah. I mean, he didn't like, you know, come and, you know, smack you on the head, but you kind of knew when you were being taken to task.
Yeah, but I think Ismail is... A lot of people say it. I mean, because he's not very prolific painter, even though he's a brilliant artist. I mean, how can you not be, right? When he was at Slade School, University of London, you know, in the early 60s, 61, I think he finished in 66. And before that, he was at Ravensbourne. So he went to two renowned art schools in London. And his teachers were, you know, his contemporary teachers were the likes of Kitaj, Lucian Freud and whatnot. And he won the first, for 2 years in a row, he won the first prize. Mm. So you don't win the first prize at the Slade for being sloppy, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, he told me that it was winning that prize, the two prizes were a burden to him because he knew he cannot be an artist when he comes back. When he came, he had to, when he returned back to Malaysia, he has to be an administrator, you know, he's got to do work. Eventually, I think he actually became an inspector of schools, you know.
Mm.
And so Ismail, actually, his real thing, sometimes I think, in Kanaga Sabapati, call him an intermediator. I would like to call him as a facilitator.
Mm.
And of course, if I wear my investment banking hat, he's actually a deal maker. You know, he will introduce Elizabeth to somebody and, you know, he can see Elizabeth floundering a little bit and then he'll point Elizabeth to the right direction to a person maybe. And then that's how he gets it. And he's always there for all the art events in Malaysia at that time. He's always in the background.
Yeah, but he never pushed himself forward.
No.
You kind of knew he was there. You didn't have to go and, you know, fawn after him. Actually, I don't think he wanted that even.
Yeah.
If we ever tried, we'd get smacked. At that point, we'd get smacked, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, not smacked, but, you know. I think that he was very, in that way, understated and underspoken, but nevertheless, you know, his presence was always there. For example, I mean, when we were doing the work at KBN that time, now it's called Aswara, but where Aswara is located, you know, complex Bidayanagara. Ana Alam, you know, was starting up, and Ana Alam was there because Ismail gave them
a place.
Right. You know, they yeah. this was, I think, the first real artist collective.
Yeah. And yeah. He officiated the founding of Ana Alam. But he was never a member of Ana Alam. He doesn't like all these hippie boys.
Yes, but no, because he wasn't young. Yeah.
So he gave them space in the likes of Latif Mohideen and whatnot. Mm. Literally, I think maybe he has to give a bit of his pay packet to keep them alive for a while.
Yeah, I mean, they survived. Really, I think with his support, that's what I mean by him sort of, you know, really the generosity was never overt, but he was generous in spirit. I think he was generous in his thought and his intellect. But he gave all of us, I mean, no matter which field of art you were in, the rein, free rein to a degree, because there was always a context.
As in his art, I think you look at some of the works that he was showing, I mean, that's being showed. You can always see a thread around some of the work that his obsession with monuments as politics of memory. He would never want to make anything too monumental. But, you know, unfortunately, as it turns out, some of his paintings are becoming monuments of Malaysian art.
Despite him trying not to.
Despite him trying not to be. So, So, Ismail, to me, was one of the greatest teacher, mainly through osmosis and through proximity, rather than being didactic. But he's a very good teacher, very good artist. Most of the students that train under him, because he was never really a teacher at ITM. He was, I think, teaching casually to come and teach drawing, giving drawing classes or aesthetic classes and whatnot. But the ones that attended his class can never forget him. I think Adman Saleh, a filmmaker that won a couple of awards here and there. Adman the other day called me up and said, look, you know, I cannot forget Ismail. My first lesson with Ismail was to bring an empty shoebox. So Adman said it was my first. He was wondering why you have to bring an empty shoebox to ITM class. You know? And Ismail said, this is how you know depth. Because Adman wanted to be a filmmaker, right? So if you want to appreciate that, you start looking into an empty shoebox.
It's so interesting that technically the both of you are here to talk about his art exhibition, but we've spent a good one third of the interview talking about him as a person, because that despite not wanting to be a legacy in that sense, I think he's ended up being one. Mm. How do you then curate an art exhibition of his work? What was your entry point into starting it?
My entry point actually was he ever only had one solo exhibition.
Was bowled over when I heard.
And it was 1988. Yep. The Macintosh just came out, and he was fiddling around. So he was taking a very big risk for his reputation as a painter, as an artist, as a writer. What is he playing around with computer, right? Painting by pixels. Of course, if you go back to the formalism of painting, yes, he's right. Painting by pixels. Everybody does that. A computer, you know, and on. But really, the entry point was a conversation that he has with Nordin Hassan, I mean, who's still alive. He's not well, 90 years old, which was his friend, his close friend. They took the boat, the ship to London, to Liverpool together, attended Kirby, and become fast friends, really, really good friends. And the conversation, Ismail never talked about himself and never wrote about himself, except for that one particular conversation between him and his friend. And he was very open about it. And I thought, okay, that's a good entry point. And I looked through some of his paintings, his artwork and whatnot. I can see where he's after. He wants to decontextualize everything. He wants to make himself like an ordinary man. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to even debase fine art from what people think it is. You know, he's not high art to him. Basically, he said that if you don't have a purpose, either a national purpose in being an artist or a national purpose of being a budayawan or a cultural activist, there's no real point, you know. Mm. And I think that was my entry point. And I found and I was wondering about his collage. I thought his idea of the pantun and whatnot, you know, the pembayang maksud and the pembayang to a maksud was a bit weird. I thought, who is this guy? You know, he cannot be he cannot be influenced by literature up to that extent, right? Then I went to Waira, went to the archive, look at some of his early works, and I found, oh yeah, he's actually were doing collages even when he was a student at Slade. So then it works. Then it's easy then.
So we do need to take a break. Uh-huh. But when we come back, I really want to hear more about what we'll be seeing at the exhibition itself. Mm. I'm speaking with curator Jaafar Ismail and Badan Warisan Malaysia's president, Elizabeth Cardosa, about an exhibit called Membayang Maksud, which revisits artist Ismail Zain's legacy, currently happening at the National Art Gallery. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sharmila Ganesan. I'm speaking with curator Jaafar Ismail of Fergana Art and Badan Warisan Malaysia's president Elizabeth Cardosa about an exhibition called Membayang Maksud at the National Art Gallery, which celebrates artist Ismail Zain's legacy. So before the break, Jaafar, you sort of alluded a little bit to where the name of this exhibition came from, Membayang Maksud. Literally speaking, it refers to the pantun, right? The pembayang. And the meaning, the two lines of a pantun.
Yeah.
But could you elaborate a little bit on the connection between that title, pantun, and Ismail Zain's work?
When I started looking at Ismail's work, right, Ismail is very fond of having to juxtapose things that are really unconnected whatsoever, right? And he start building... there was one writer, I think Don Zain, wrote that Ismail's specialty in a magazine called Plita years ago in the 70s, early 70s, Ismail's created his own space within a very tight frame. So he's actually a special artist. And I found that if I look at this painting, it doesn't make sense until you start looking from a collage idea of a pantun. There's always pembayang, totally unrelated to the purpose of the painting. And then you can see probably some meanings coming in. But really, Ismail's work is almost unfinished. You know? And then Christian Jit, I think, said something like, Ismail's work is almost like always becoming into something. The idea of the state of becoming is actually a film idea, a filmmaker's idea. Mm-hmm. You know, like you make a movie, you never really end. You're never really sure when it end or when it begin and whatnot. And then it clicked on me that this idea of the wayang, Ismail is obsessed about the wayang. So I started the exhibition actually with one of his famous painting, Serahkan Serahkan Yilit Yilit, you know, which is talk about the power of the dalang, the power of the person who write the script of the every wayang and perform, more powerful than the characters, more powerful than the audience, but draw in the audience and push the, I mean, almost the script almost trying to get the audience to surrender all their soul and their hearts and their views to the text. So this is a very complicated man, I thought. But if all these years looking at Ismail's work, because he's not a prolific painter, you'll find that everything is disconnected. But the digital collage work, maybe it's the computer that helped him, speed, offers him speed. He can do things that many 45, 50 works or whatever, they're actually coherent.
Mm. This is some of the earliest examples of digital collage work done in Malaysia, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Is this exhibition only showing that work, or you're also comparing it to his paintings?
No, what I did was, for the exhibition, I pick up about 10 paintings and a few more from the family and also for the national collection. And I juxtapose them against his digital collages and see whether the story is there, whether the narrative exists, whether there's... So as it turned out, I mean, it works out quite well. There's a series of digital collages that shows clearly Ismail was making a movie, influenced by the movies, by film. And there's also cultural icons. He decontextualized, for example, Sharifa Aini, Sahara Yaakob, and Liza Manley into totally something else, you know, including Bruce Springsteen. So his influence. And then his love affair with structural anthropology, which is what he's demonstrating how he cares about his people, Malays especially, and in the process of Malaysians, in the rural urbanization issue. I think that. And then there's also towards the later part of his life, his paintings were more meditative. Huh? Meditative, but very expressive. In fact, his last, most, the ones that is regarded as his last particular work, the wedding of Sultan Mansur Shah with Putri Hang Lipo, is actually almost suggesting that this, you know, the multiracialness and the plural nature of this country, it is the answer to the existence, mm-hmm. I mean, to the formation of Malaysia, or it becomes like the national purpose. The national purpose is multiracialism and plural society. You know? Mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting person. But very not overt. He's never pushed it. There's hardly any slogan.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that surprised me is that the other thing we did for the exhibition is Kanaga Sabapati and me and Adin, we are compiling all the essays written by Ismail Zain to be translated into English. The ones in Malay translated in English. Produce a volume, maybe 45, 50 essays selected by Kanaga that will be published towards the end of the exhibition and after the exhibition.
Mm. Elizabeth, as someone who works with National Heritage, could you help situate where his art sits within this idea of a National Heritage of art?
I think that, you know, picking up from what Jaffa was saying about this, he was a nationalist. I mean, in the true sense of the word, you know, he believed completely in Malaysia. And that's demonstrated in all his work. And as Pengarah Kebudayaan, you know, as Director General Finas, he wasn't exclusive to only supporting any one group of people. He didn't throw his weight only, you know, to supporting the Malay cause, whatever that might mean. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the work that KBN was doing, the work that the ministry was doing at that time, it was the early days of this notion of multicultural, a mix. But it was a celebration. And I think that from the, you know, we've kind of sometimes lost that. You know, we've lost it in the sense of we've taken it, it's more formularistic. At that time, it was a lot more adventurous. Yeah. You know, it was a young country. You know, we're talking about the 70s. You know, we were very much coming into our own with... It's what I call the post-69 syndrome, but he was comfortable in that skin. And I think from the heritage perspective, if you're looking at how, when I remember his first digital collage show, there was so much criticism. I mean, and I remember that, you know, people were looking at it and saying, because nobody understood it. It was just far too, it was... Far too. Yeah.
Some of his ideas were a little bit testy at that time.
Yes, yes.
Because looking at it now.
He had this work that's titled The Teratai Circuit. The Teratai Circuit is actually a very, very provocative work. It's actually a work that looks very simple, just lotus flowers. You know? But it's actually a definition of Nusantara, of Southeast Asia. Mm. But it's also drawing the sources, the lotus. The lotus is a plant or flower that's got some kind of kesucian or sacredness, be it throughout Southeast Asia. And that actually came from Hindu Buddhism. Mm. So there's acceptance of the fact that... So he used that throughout his digital collage, little lotus floating up, even in his big paintings, lotus at the floor. And that to him almost saying that, this Nusantara, this is the foundation of this area. And it's a melting pot of... the old cultures of, you know, that's influenced by Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam and whatnot. So we just have to be comfortable inside our own skin with this kind of heritage that we have. I think that's what he's proposing. Very provocative, especially in 1988.
You know? I think that, you know, if you're looking at it from this notion of roots, I think he understood roots, the roots, like if you're talking about the roots of a plant, but he also understood roots, the R-O-U-T-E-S, as, you know, this movement and this transition and the country, really, and culturally, we are. That was what he encouraged. He encouraged that in fine art. He encouraged that in film. He encouraged that in dance. He encouraged that in theatre. And it was really a big... I think, you know, a big, not resurgence, it was a surgence, I don't know what the word is. You know, it was this coming together of different minds, different people. And as a young person, you know, just being on the periphery of it, it was really quite amazing to see these people work together. Mm. And the opportunities that he gave us, okay, like you can do this. And, you know, he gave us opportunities to be involved in things that I think nowadays, you know, we would never have been able to access. I mean, young people would just never, because the hierarchy is quite clear. Mm. He broke down that hierarchy. We didn't feel it. It was there, but we didn't feel it.
Yeah.
I think he was able to, you know, undermine it, or to not undermine it, but to disentangle it. Mm. And so that we could get into the gaps. And I think that if you look at people of my generation and the generation after us, if you take every decade as a generation of people involved in the arts in Malaysia, you will see that Ismail did affect us, you know, and the fact that he was there did affect.
Yeah. I mean, how not to? He was the first, you know, when KL has the arts festival in 1986, you know, and I think he just retired from
Finance. He was the artistic director.
He was the artistic director. He was a guy, you know, organizing dancers in KL Padang and whatnot. So that's his idea, because his idea, he had this word in his very big lecture, the Tun Sri Lanang lecture, a phrase that seni harus dipersenangkan. You have to make arts easy for people.
Yeah, I like
so,
that.
And then he started giving, he supported, you know, folk art, theatre. So...
And did you ever see the posters that came out of the work from that? You know, because he had Victor Chin, he had Said Ahmad Jamal. He actually invited major artists, graphic artists, painters, who then contributed posters. I think there were about six, if I remember correctly. I think I have them all somewhere. Yeah. And who then designed these posters, which were then given out. Freely, and they were celebrating really this festival, and it was really that whole mix, you know. People he allowed people to collaborate, just express themselves,
And then he pushed UMBC to sponsor the first public sculpture by Syed Ahmad Jamal, Puncak Purnama.
Yeah.
That was then demolished.
Yes,
so that
yes.
was actually part of the KL Arts Festival, the opening of it. So he's and his rivalry with Syed Ahmad Jamal is quite well known, right? I mean, it's quite well documented. But the idea of Ismail Zain as an artist, how does he react to a rivalry? In 1979, Syed Ahmad Jamal had an exhibition and published his book called Rupa dan Jiwa, which is basically selling out a story of the Nusantara, the Malayness culture and whatnot. And Ismail responded with his famous book called Seni dan Imajan, Art and Imagery, right? Which was then, he had a one-person exhibition showing things like little things like cave paintings from Itambun, from Niah and whatnot, you know. And then also a bit of his art, handicrafts and whatnot. So Seni dan Imajan, Art and Imagery is famous. We're going to be translated in English for the book for the first time, so hopefully people can understand what this guy is all about. He's actually saying that, look, you know, Malaya, this peninsula, doesn't start with Parameswara. There was something else way before Parameswara. So that's how he is.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of his digital collage, Happy Birthday Parameswara, was actually a funny take, was a cynical take, a skeptical take about how we define the Malaysian history or the Malayan history, begin with Parameswara, Melaka Sultanate, and nothing before that.
Mm. Elizabeth, you mentioned earlier young people. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear actually from both of you about the relevance of the kind of art that Ismail Zain created to today, you know, when for both audiences and artists, what is there for us to learn about arts making?
Yeah, to me, I mean, first, one of the key things I thought was risk-taking. When he did the digital collage, he was 58 years old, retired from three big jobs, well-known painter. He was risking his reputation. And that alone, the idea of taking risks, the young artist should know that you can actually do something even when you are that old, that matured, number one. Second, he's very forward-looking. He's not trapped by medium. He accepted the new medium of the digital world is going to emerge. So he embraced it. At his age, he started fiddling around with a computer. Not very easy. Not very easy.
And not with those old
and those
devices.
Computers,
not,
yeah. You know, computers. Those old computers to actually create this kind of, now you talk about,
so
you
the,
know.
The idea of ambition, projection into the future, and fearless almost at his age. That the young people should look at it. And of course, and then the subject matter. The subject matter is still, we still have our own sociological problem. We still have the problem of how we are not still not comfortable in our own skin with our relationship with nation building, with the idea of the nation state. And the content in his digital collage, you can see that. He's got this catfish that's going floating around most of his collages, and his catfish is the metaphor that's quite interesting. The cat, the most Malay literature, the metaphor for when they use fish, the metaphor is always using freshwater fish, because basically, you know, I don't know why, but catfish is not a very friendly fish, you know, because it bites you, right? Yeah. It sting out, it sting you, so it's not a friendly fish. But he used that. So he used that as a metaphor for the Malays, for the people of the Nusantara, for all of us. But it's also a metaphor of power. So at some point in time in 1988, Ismail Zain was really, really concerned about power, you know, about the idea of power, the futility of power, which is how the play Chindai started. Mm. Him and Nordin Hassan, wrote and directed the play, and Ismail did the set design.
Yeah.
The first version of Chindai that was staged in November 1988 in DBKL was all about power. Mm. The second one, that was filmed and staged by Adman Saleh and then for TV3 and on, was very religious. It was very Islamic. So two different views. Like 1988 was about power, but Ismail as an artist was not blind or deaf. 1986 was the fight between the Malay body polity, Dr. Mahathir and Tengku Razali. 1987 was Oprah Silalang and the stock market crash. 1988, he produced a set of very coherent work, almost structural anthropology work about the country that is very, can be quite provocative.
Mm. I think, at that time, certainly it was, and the challenge also, if you think about it, was, you know, the medium that he was using, because it was just like, say what, you know? Mm. It was completely not part of any of the narratives, certainly not the art narrative, not the cultural narrative. So in that way, but I think that his if you look at his work and you look at how he viewed things, you know, through his work, and when you talk to him, he had a very, I think, positive, I would say, take on, you know, us as a people, that we would come together. I mean, and that was really how he, because you could see his friends. I mean, who he surrounded himself with. Mm. I think you were very privileged, I think, to be allowed that kind of entry. He wasn't exclusive, but you always knew when he was, you know, you would be, you would be embraced into a circle, let's say, yeah?
He's always there.
And yeah.
But he's always a specialist of the afterthought. That worries me quite a lot. Okay, he will say something. Yeah. It will take me like 8 hours later to figure out, is that what he told me? Is that what he meant?
But he would take us aside and he would, you know, we could go for coffee and you would sit down and chat with him if you had problems. I mean, as a young person again, you know, just talking about, you know, trying to figure something out or, you know, directions. And he would help you just be that sounding block. And I think that's why I say he influenced a lot of us, because he was around to provide, not to dictate and not to be the impresario, but really for us to discuss things with and to figure it out ourselves. Yeah. And I think that for me personally, as you know, on a personal front, that's what I was always very grateful for. He was not, and there was no such thing as, there was no this race politics, there was none of that, you know, language. You could move, you could switch code, you could do whatever you needed and wanted to navigate all of that without even thinking about it. It wasn't conscious. And I think that was, you know, really, for me, working with the Kementerian Kebudayaan as an outsider, really. I mean, you know, what says young Chico at 21, you know, coming in and sitting in to formal meetings, you know, but he allowed that entry. And I think that, and I've heard from some artist friends, you know, who again were just allowed the space to do their kind of work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Latif Muhyiddin in 1973, very young Latif Muhyiddin then, Ismail Zin gave him, when he was director at the Balai Seni Lukis in Jalan Ampang, gave him the first retrospective that Balai Seni Lukis ever had of a Malaysian artist.
Is that so?
Was to a young artist called Latif Muhyiddin in 1973. and that was risk-taking because, I mean, there were all these Penang artists, you know, who were 70 years old, 60 years old, who probably deserved it at that time. But Ismail decided to take a risk on a young artist. But having said that, you know, he always had problem with expressionism as an artwork, as an abstract expressionism, because he's more cerebral.
Yeah.
He's very cerebral. Yeah. And he, there's no sense of journey at all in his work. I mean, you don't see the expressive brush strokes and whatnot. Mm. And although I believe this particular exhibition exposes to another work that from the London School that now become part of the National Collection, a very small sketch drawing, quite big painting, but it's a sketch for Burung Tio 1967. It clearly shows Ismail must have done some beautiful paintings, but we don't know where they are now.
Mm.
You know, he must have left it in Jalan the storeroom in Jalan Bellamy. We don't know where they are.
The story that I grew up with from my parents seeing was that one day Ismail got really fed up with what was happening in the art world, and he just burnt his paintings.
Oh. Yeah.
So that's the story that my parents told us. Whether that actually happened or not, I don't know. But that was in Kota Bharu. Yeah. And that was all his early work that he came back with.
From the London School.
From the London School. And so what is left, I suppose, is...
The Rembrandt.
Yes. Yeah. Not many pieces, but just, you know, imagine what it could have been, I suppose, if we had looked at it as a body of work.
I'd like to hear from each of you. Maybe we can start with you, Elizabeth. In Membayang Maksud, what are some of the works that for you are definitive of Ismail Zain?
I suppose when you enter and you see that main painting, which is the marriage of
Mansur Shah,
and you look at that. When I look at that, and all the things about him sort of fall into place for me, you know, that his expression, his Malayness, but his understanding of history, but his non judgmental, but the very decorative nature of the piece, you know, and his use of very very simple. I suppose, you know, for example, his airbrush work.
Yeah.
You know, using the plastic floral mat. Mm. You know, and when you look at that, you kind of go like, oh, you know, the memory of, I don't know, sitting in somebody's house, you know, and that being your tablecloth, your plastic tablecloth. Yeah. Yeah. And then representing that on an artwork, you know, in this marriage. I mean, that whole sense of it, for me, it is... It speaks of the rest. I think, of course, by way of Rembrandt, that painting, which is sort of like the start, and then this is the finish of his career. As an artist, you know, if we're looking at it in that way, that's such an incredible figurative piece. I mean, it is such an incredible drawing, and not just very sensual, but just beautiful. And when you look, and color-wise as well, I think, you know, he had a great sense of use of color. So in his digital work, when you see this pixelated dot matrix kind of, you know, and that contrast, I remember his exhibition, I mean, in 88, seeing that work and at first being really like, you know, what, and then you really had to sit, stand and read each piece. To try to figure it out and to try to figure out the connections. But I think if you look at the start and the finish, for me, those are things to note because they remind me of him, you know, and the way he used to talk.
And a great reflection of the title, Mumbai Maksud, doesn't it? And what about you, Jaffa? What are some of, or what is perhaps the highlight for you when it comes to this exhibition?
The highlight for me personally as a curator, I felt that I was very successful to actually manage to actually put this thing together, bring some of the older works, put that against some of the newer works, the one I thought was more coherent, which is a digital collage. And suddenly I found that this guy has never lost his trick. You know, he's never missed his trick. He knew it. He knew what was going on. And I thought, this is what they call a cerebral artist, you know. And in Malay, they say, ini artist mesti baca.
Yeah.
I said, wow, you know. Yeah. But that to me, and then as the exhibition grows up over the last few weeks, people are reading it differently. And I, one of the media piece by, I think, Harian Metro, it was quite funny. So she interviewed me. She listened to what I was saying as a curator. And then she then framed the painting as paparan pergolakan orang Melayu, you know. That's just a few days before the Congress Maruah Melayu. So I thought, wow, these people are reading it differently. And there's another review by other artists who thought that I was not Islamic enough. You know, I did not expound on the Islamic visual grammar. And then there's other artists, they said that I didn't push hard enough on structural anthropology issues. But I thought Ismail is not an overt guy, you know. Even he doesn't quite enjoy going out with all the wealthy people, you know, the art. But the one that really affected me the most, is a very small print called the Garden Party. It's about people attending functions wearing masks of death, you know. And that's very interesting because, and then I related back to a short essay that he wrote in Dewan Budaya, which titled Sandwich Tuna, Roti Jala, and Mihun Goreng. Basically, it's about the people who attended art exhibitions, and then they don't really go there for the art. They just go there to present themselves in the way they thought society would like to see them. So it's very interesting. That actually was the most fantastic very small piece, yeah. But he actually said, maybe I'm also bringing people to the garden party myself.
Thank you so much.
So his commentary, right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jaffa. Yeah. Thank you, Elizabeth.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with curator Jaffa Ismail and Badan Warisan Malaysia's president Elizabeth Cardosa about an exhibition called Membayang Maksud at the National Art Gallery. The show honours the legacy of Malaysian artist and cultural icon Ismail Zain, and it's on until the 17th of November. For more information, visit artgallery.gov.my. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous Front Row segments, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my, on our BFM app, or on Spotify. You've been listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.